I suppose I'd say that although the language of anti-slavery activists in Britain is one that is infused with religious as well as moral kind of meaning and moral kind of anxiety, that's kind of inseparable from the kind of material economic sort of circumstances of the time. And I suppose one of the things I've been particularly interested in is the ways in which historians have often tended to treat religious language about slavery as a kind of moral humanitarian rhetoric. But to people at the time who really believed this, it often included actually kind of temporal, real world kind of ideas as well as spiritual claims. And so crucially, an idea that God was either kind of actively involved in punishing people in this world as well as in the next world, or an idea that his laws of the world were kind of inscribed with long-term punishments for evil and rewards for good, actually meant that when abolitionists talked about God, no sort of good can ever come of an ungodly enterprise such as this traffic in Africa and things like that, they were actually also making temporal arguments about the future prosperity of the country. So they were making arguments saying that, you know, well, this sort of gambling, speculative trade in slaves might be profitable in the short term, but in the long term, it will turn out to be a self-defeating trade, or a sort of so an idea almost that either it was based on deception or short-term profits and not sustainable. And so those start to blend into kind of economic arguments, and they start to incorporate the economic changes that are happening during this age of revolutions. So in particular, issues to do with, you know, the kind of supply and price of sugar, rising costs of defending the Caribbean colonies, which Aaron Graham, a great researcher at UCL, has been doing some work on. And so you can kind of see how, what I would always say is that it's very rarely the case that material economic changes reflexively lead to something happening in history, because the way that humans process and translate changes and understand them and string them together into a story affects their actions. Yeah. And their actions, their economic beliefs, end up becoming themselves economic facts, because it changes people's behaviour, and people's behaviour is what makes the material structures. So I suppose what I'd say is that, kind of in a sense, asking is it moral or economic, the interesting thing is the links between the two, not the binary choice.
Yeah, so it could have been one the same, not, it wasn't two separate camps.
Yeah, or at least sort of the economic, the big sort of structural changes happening around us, the meaning we put on them and the way we respond to them is kind of translated and processed by our languages and the belief kind of that we impose on it, yeah. How we understand and react to stuff. And then our reactions itself create sort of, you know, new material changes in behaviour and economic behaviour and stuff. So in a sense, I've kind of ended up trying to draw into the stuff I'm doing on abolitionism some of the different sort of strands of social science work recently that have thought about behavioural economics or market performativity, basically the ways in how we study economics as a kind of rational choice exercise, but actually the people making those decisions are usually being framed by lots of kind of really human kind of gut instincts or faith or confidence in what they're doing and so on. So I guess I always come back to, I think John Maynard Keynes said that, you know, there's no such thing as investment, there's only speculation. And it's that sense to which everybody basically, when they're making decisions, is making guesses about the future.